is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.
Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.
You are Locked On Cavaliers, your daily podcast on the Cleveland Cavaliers, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
So joining the show today, of course, is Ian Levy from Fanside. Ian, what's going on?
Nothing. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. So let's start with the broad implications of this series for both teams. Let's start with the Cavs. Did you learn anything from this series about Cleveland that you didn't know already?
I don't think so. I mean, it went about the way I expected. I guess I'm surprised that they didn't... I guess I'm surprised they sort of let the Pacers hang around as much as they did. You know, I expected a sweep. I expected, you know, some of the defensive problems show up. I expected a game or two would be tight, all play well. But I guess I didn't expect all four games to sort of be as tight as they were. But, you know, four games by 16 points or whatever it was, but they still Pacers and they still, you know, looked like the better team by a huge margin.
Yeah, it felt to me a lot like the Pistons series from last year. Not like necessarily physical, but close, kind of competitive, them having to actually do stuff and respond in certain ways to win. Like, and I think that is sort of all you really were looking for, because I don't know how much I was actually expecting to learn. I kind of had these things where I was wondering, okay, does LeBron have to engage? Like, will the defense look better? Like, I still don't really know. I don't think we got, like, an answer of, like, how much better the defense will get. I think they tried different stuff. But, like, how much of that stuff is actually applicable to a Golden State series, to a Washington series? Like, I don't know how much of that stuff actually is translatable, because they're not going to be able to just, like, double Kevin Durant, right? Like, they can't just, like, do what they did against Paul George in that series. Like, they'll get toasted if they do that.
Yeah, I don't think the Pacers had the personnel or the... I mean, I don't want to dump on McMillan, but I don't think the Pacers sort of had the coaching, the game planning, or the personnel to really sort of test the Cavaliers or sort of push them strategically to, you know, sort of make them make adjustments. The most obvious thing for me was that Cleveland just could sort of move the matchups around, and, you know, the Pacers could sort of make these minor changes, you know, at the beginning, you know, switching those pick and rolls, and LeBron was just, you know, killing Teague or whoever he got matched up on down in the post. And then when the Pacers sort of made that adjustment, they just moved the advantage somewhere else. And then it was, you know, Kyrie Irving taking somebody off the dribble, or then it's, you know, Love getting a mismatch in the post. And I think the Cavaliers have more than enough experience making these kinds of, like, minor in-game shifts where it's just, you know, here's the spot where the ball needs to go now, here's the spot where the obvious advantage is. And so I don't think the Pacers sort of had much to challenge them with beyond that. I think, you know, obviously Paul George is a special player, and he really sort of stretched their perimeter defense quite a bit, but you know, I don't think they're going to see a guy like that again. I don't think they're going to get the Bulls. I don't think they're going to get Giannis and the Bucks. So I don't think they sort of have to worry about that kind of single, you know, offensive focal point that they need to, you know, scheme for. And honestly, they didn't, you know, scheme that much for Paul George, and they still were able to sort of absorb what he did.
Yeah, the extent of the scheme was, we're going to not have LeBron on him, we're going to double him a lot, and then make Montellus beat us. Like, that's, like, not really a very complex, like, layered strategy. Which isn't surprising, I guess, because I don't know. I also don't know what the Cavs actually have in their bag of tricks to get better on defense. Like, the whole reason I think it could get better is they have the same group from last year, but like, they've been bad all year, and they're not rebounding as well either.
Mm-hmm.
If you were Indiana, what would you have maybe done differently? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that's part of the argument. I think the idea that they sort of have another gear in terms of execution and energy, I think that argument might sort of be flawed. I think clearly, I can't remember who wrote this piece for us in the rotation, but it was like LeBron is the switch.
Wes Goldberg, shout out to Wes Goldberg.
Wes. So it's LeBron is the switch. If they're going to flip the switch in the playoffs, it's LeBron going supernova. I mean, he's the guy who can sort of, like, you know, ratchet his intensity up and take the whole team to another level. In terms of their defense being better by being sort of sharper, crisper, you know, everybody else playing a lot harder, I'm not sure that that's I'm not sure that there's a huge amount of improvement to be had there. I don't know that that really moves the needle a ton. But I think you're right that their ability to sort of scheme, adjust, change lineups, cross match. I think they have, they have so many veteran guys. They have so much experience in that way. And they, you know, they certainly didn't really have to do it against the Pacers. There's no impetus to do that down the stretch in the regular season. I think there's a chance that if they get into a playoff matchup that's, you know, really sort of testing them, whether it's maybe Boston, Toronto, or, you know, whoever might hypothetically match up with them in the finals, I think there are some strategic switches that could be flipped that they just sort of haven't had to bother with yet.
Yeah, and I kind of think the interesting question I have heading into round two is how much can you actually play Korver against certain teams? Because I think their best defensive lineup might be Shumpert, Smith, LeBron, RJ, Thompson. And I think Korver, like, if you can't play him against DeRozan. If DeRozan and Lowry are both out there, I don't think. I think he might have a hard time defending Norm Powell at this point, so I think that's sort of like an interesting thing. Are you willing to sacrifice what he offers as a shooter and floor spacing? And Deron Williams is kind of the same thing. Like, can you play a guy when he's sort of a net negative on the net, but just providing that much on the offensive end? Because he was really, really good in game four, was like pivotal in kind of winning the second quarter of that game and kind of helping them hit a different level. Do you think Indiana could have done anything differently in this series?
Say that one more time.
Do you think Indiana could have done anything significantly different in this series?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, they could have put Stevenson in the starting lineup, earlier on. They could have cut Ellis's minutes. Some of the defensive strategy stuff was sort of, I don't know, transparently flawed, and they sort of stuck with it for a while. And then their late game execution was so sort of just sloppy and disjointed. You know, it was like what you would expect to see, like, during the first couple weeks of the season when guys are sort of, like, new and still getting to know each other and still sort of figuring out where everybody's spots are, not like a team that had just played 82 games together.
Yeah.
They just looked so out of sorts. There's probably some changes the Pacers could have made, but, I mean, on balance, I think the best scenario the Pacers could have hoped for in this series is they win one, maybe two games. The difference between where they ended up losing four close games and maybe, you know, winning one or two and getting blown out in the rest, I don't think they're that far off from sort of their best case scenario here.
Yeah, I think, like, if George plays better in game four, like, they maybe win that game just because of how the Cavs played late, and then you have the LeBron thing that got reversed. Should have been travel when he hit the go-ahead three. This Lance thing's really interesting to me because the Cavs are just very content to let him shoot. And, like, he was very happy to oblige them. So I don't really know. I'm kind of unsure of how much of a difference he makes when he's starting, just because the Cavs were sagging off of him and just kind of letting him be Lance. And it, like, worked. But then, like, there are times where it kind of went the other direction. So I'm not really all aboard of the the Lance thing. I think, like, C.J. Miles, if he has a better series, that would have helped. Teague, I think, kind of maybe having more consistent games would help. And I think Miles Turner, to me, is the guy because he had all that space in the middle. It didn't really look to him a ton either. But if he has a bigger series, that I think could have, especially against Channing Frye when he's in those minutes, I think that could have maybe pushed the Cavs a little bit more than we saw.
Yeah, I think the advantage to Lance is mostly on the defensive end, being much bigger than Ellis and being much more engaged on that end. And I think, we had sort of a real small sample size with Lance and Paul George together the second time around. But my sense of the last year, with Lance and George together in Indiana, the first time around, you know, with Hibbert and West, was I really thought when Lance was on the floor, George played better because he got to spend a lot more time without the ball in his hands. And over the past, like, 2 years, playing without Lance, it seems like he has sort of gravitated to playing more on the ball. And I think it sort of lends itself to his some of the weaknesses in his offensive game, his tendency to settle for pull-up, mid-range jumpers. And that, you know, for as skilled an offensive player as he is, I still think they just get more bang for his offensive buck when he's sort of more of a secondary creator, when he's attacking, you know, a disorganized defense. And so when Lance is out there, it seems like George sort of settles into that role and is more, not quite as much this time around. He's sort of in a different spot in his career. But the first time around, it seemed like he was comfortable playing that role next to Lance. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I guess it remains to be seen what that looks like next year and how that sort of fits together. But, the past 2 years with George, I think he really sort of leaned into some of the softer parts of his offensive game. I don't mean that like he's a soft player. I just like the things that he's not quite as good at or the things that sort of don't draw out the most efficiency. It seems like he was willing to sort of lean into those a little bit more.
Yeah, I think game one was a game he had a huge game, but I think he didn't score a single point in the paint or at the rim. Like, he didn't really attack a relatively soft inside of the Cavs defense. He was very, and the Cavs, that's to his credit that he was making all these jump shots, but he wasn't kind of putting the Cavs on their heels, I think, in interesting ways. But I think maybe some of that is you don't see a lot of LeBron on him in this series. I think you saw a lot of J.R. Smith giving him space. We talked about that a little bit, but that to me was just something I don't know what to make of that Cavs defensive strategy. I know it doesn't, like, translate in a lot of series, but I mean, like, did we learn anything again about that defense at all from how they did that? Because I think the one thing that you could take away is that they did rotate pretty hard, and that they were at least, like, trying, but it didn't always work, and they gave up a lot of points in the series.
Yeah, they did. I mean, they definitely made the Pacers look really good at times. I think I wonder if some of that strategy with LeBron and not putting him on Paul George is just the fact that they didn't really feel threatened, and that they felt like George could score 40 points and they could still beat the Pacers pretty easily. And so, you know, maybe wasn't a lot of sort of pressure to shut George down and to sap LeBron's energy, to use it up for that task if they didn't necessarily need him to do that. The other thing is the idea of LeBron, putting your best defender on the other team's best offensive player isn't always sort of the best way to maximize your defensive return. That sometimes putting your best defender on the second best offensive player and sort of like completely removing that player from the offense, provide sort of a more marginal return. And the best example I can always think of this is the Pacers actually in those series against the Heat, when they used to put Paul George on Dwayne Wade and move Stevenson onto LeBron. And George was able to bother Wade so much more that sort of the drop-off between George and Stevenson on LeBron was more than made up for by how much more George was able to bother Wade than Lance was. And so, I don't know that the best defense is always just sort of stacking up the number one offensive wing player against the number one defensive wing player and sort of letting them do their thing.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. I'm intrigued to see if the Cavs like play Toronto, which it looks like it's going to happen. Does he defend DeRozan at all? Do they try to hide him on Powell or DeMar Carroll? If they play Milwaukee, does he defend Middleton? Does he defend Giannis? Like, I'm kind of intrigued by what they might do there. Just because I think in both the situations, I think there's benefits to putting LeBron on those guys. Like, I don't think J.R. Smith's going to hang with Giannis. But, does LeBron want to put it with the physicality of DeRozan when he's going to be doing so much on offense? I think those are sort of interesting, because I think if the Cavs do face Golden State in the finals, I think you probably have to put LeBron on Draymond quite a bit. I think that's kind of your only option.
Yeah, it seems like that's the matchup on the Warriors. With Milwaukee, my guess is that LeBron would have to spend quite a bit of time on Giannis. I just, him being so big, it doesn't seem like there's another sort of plausible matchup. I guess maybe you end up with, Jefferson on him
he doesn't want to
play Jefferson for all of Giannis's minutes.
Right, and Jefferson doesn't, move, the way Giannis does. He's a very solid defender when he's moving side to side and using his hands. Giannis kind of can just beat Giannis himself around, to verb him. He can just kind of move himself around those type of situations, I think. Like, he's just so long, so athletic. I don't know if Jefferson's, built for that.
Yeah.
I mean, he's ancient, so.
Sorry, go ahead.
Richard's ancient.
Yeah. The Toronto matchup's interesting for me because I guess I can see some comparison to the Pacers where putting LeBron on DeRozan sort of in a vacuum makes the most sense, but I could see an argument for the Cavaliers being willing to put a less high quality defender on DeRozan and sort of encourage the Raptors to funnel their offense in that direction, both because DeRozan and Lowry have been sort of so inconsistent and up and down from game to game over the past 2-3 years in the playoffs, and it's carried right into this year. But also, DeRozan's game, as great as he's been this year, is sort of inherently less efficient than kick out three pointers to Lowry or Patrick Patterson or Serge Ibaka or something like that. And so, it might be to the Cavaliers' advantage to have, to have DeRozan feel like he has an advantage and have him shooting, 25 times a game as opposed to sort of letting their offense be more balanced and spread it around.
Yeah, I mean, if Lowry's not driving against Kyrie, that's probably a win for the Cavs. Because, Kyrie. But the other thing I think in this series too was interesting. That games 3 and 4, LeBron really, I thought, was the driving force. Kyrie and Love both played better in game 4 than they did in game 3. Kyrie had a lot of points, didn't have any assists, but guys were 0-6 on the shot attempts. Love didn't shoot well in that game, has 16 rebounds, blocked DeRozan at one point. What did you make of their play over the course of this series?
I thought they looked really good in the first two games. I feel like it's sort of hard to judge because, not to just sort of hammer this point, but I don't think they really felt that pressured by the Pacers. I don't feel like they really felt that threatened. And so I don't think that there was sort of that motivation to draw out these really high-energy performances from them. And so, the places where they struggled, I don't think that they felt that concerned about it, and I don't know. I wouldn't read too much into the game 3 or game 4 performances, especially since game 1 and game 2 is sort of where they, through their knockout punches, sort of established that they were not going to be troubled by the Pacers, and those are the games where Irving and Love played really well. So I think as things move forward, I think they're going to be fine. I think their offense I think their offense looks pretty good. It seems like they've got a nice rhythm. LeBron seems like he's ready to, step up and be enormous when they need him to be. So, I think it's kind of tightening screws and looking at the individual matchups from here on out.
Yeah, I agree. I can understand not playing him in the fourth of game 3 when LeBron and that bench just was obliterating Indiana. But game 4, people were saying maybe Darren should be in this game 1. I thought Kyrie played relatively pretty well, and he had that offensive rebound late. Actually had a play where he was pretty aware on defense as well, which is, a rarity for him. And I thought Love, rebounded really, really well. And for him, if he can rebound at that level, I think that helps the Cavs' defense, even if he's not this lockdown, really good defender. I think you kind of have to have him on the floor for rebounding purposes at the very least. And I kind of agree with you. I wonder what causes them to like make this jump, right? Like, I think LeBron is there. What gets Kyrie there? Like, what gets Kyrie chasing Kyle Lowry on screens? Like, is it because I kind of think that might have to be it, because I can't really imagine him like playing any different than he did in this series and hitting that next gear if he's chasing around Brogdon or chasing around Dele, like around screens. Like, I just can't imagine that's going to be something that gets him really going.
Yeah, I think for Love, it seems like it has to do with Love. It seems very sort of like situational, and when he's sort of encouraged and welcomed into the offensive flow early, and it seems in that sort of progression of exploiting matchups, it seems like he's the obvious third. Like, if LeBron has an advantage, they go to him first, and then it's Kyrie. And then, you know, Love is sort of the third person on that flow chart. And so those games where he sort of has those opportunities to come in at the beginning of a half and be really involved, it seems like that sparks, that often sparks something for him. And yeah, for Kyrie, I wonder if it's just about feeling challenged, feeling like there's something to get up for. There's not a lot of heat in this series. Like, when you look at some of the other series and these, salty post-game press conferences and, people shoving and taking shots at each other, in the media, it didn't seem like there was really much of that at all here with Cleveland and Indiana. And so I wonder if they just sort of need some of that juice. They need Toronto or Boston or somebody to say something before the series starts and say, we think this is the year we're going to knock the Cavs off and whatever, and that just sort of draws it out.
Yeah, I do think there's a little bit of bad blood with Milwaukee, because they played so hard against the Cavs. There's a Kyrie quote where he said, "I'd like to play them four times in the playoffs." and he said that in like November. That's there. And I think one dirty Dele play, which probably will happen. I mean, if that series doesn't look like it's going to happen, but like that would, I think, probably get people going too. Do you think either of those teams actually gives the Cavs any trouble?
I still think Toronto is probably the best bet. It's hard to, it's really hard to say, because that's like totally based on paper, and the way they struggled through the first part of that series against Milwaukee did not inspire faith. But I think on paper they have the pieces. They've got more pieces, I think, than Boston or Washington or Milwaukee, or certainly Milwaukee or Atlanta do. They've got sort of multiple layers of defenders where they can, they can play big or they can play small and still, be able to defend at a high level. They can play big or they can play small and still sort of, have their offensive integrity intact and play fast or slow. So I think their Toronto ability to sort of adapt with Cleveland and also, make some adjustments and maybe force some adaptations on Cleveland's part. It seems like that's the biggest sort of challenge that's lurking out there in the East. Boston sort of has looked flawed through this Chicago series. Looks like they'll probably get through Chicago now, and some of the things that Boston's really struggled with, the Cavs might not be able to do to them. I don't know that the Cavs are going to sort of destroy them on the offensive glass in quite the same way, but Thompson Love lineups could certainly really push Boston around a little bit. But yeah, I think probably Toronto's the one that's sort of lurking and gives them the toughest look.
I agree. I think they need to play Patterson more than they have so far. I think he can cause the Cavs some problems. Pull Tristan out of the paint a little bit. Good rebounder, good defender too. I agree with you. I think I would have said Washington, and I have said Washington, but they've looked kind of wonky the last two games against Atlanta, so I'm kind of my belief in the Wizards is kind of waning a little bit. And like in game four, they look kind of awful on defense for parts of that second half. Let's look at Indiana for a second, Ian. I wrote about this, you and I talked about this off the pod a little bit. What's next for Indiana? What's next, and specifically for Paul George? I mean, is this the end? Should it be the end? Like, where do you think they go from here?
Yeah, I don't know. I have a hard time sort of guessing at what they will do. My sense of it is that they're probably better off trading George And it's really complicated because, you know, they went through some lean years with their fans, and it took a while to sort of build up some enthusiasm there again. And I think they're still, you know, their attendance numbers are not great. And so, you know, trading a super marketable, you know, star like Paul George might have some serious financial or business implications that, you know, that I'm not savvy enough to talk about. But in terms of basketball, I'm not sure what they do. I'm not sure what they do this summer that makes them any better than they were this year. And that's their clock on George. You know, he can become a free agent next summer. And so they sort of have a year to sell him on this. And I'm not sure what they can do in a year that, you know, pushes them up a tier and makes that argument to him that this is the best place to win. And so if that's the, you know, if that's the clock, I think maybe they're better off trading. And the really hard part is I don't know that they get a deal that's full equal value for him. But I think, you know, they're probably better off looking to try and load up on picks. You know, if you can get a couple first rounders for George, I think you have to look really hard at that. And, you know, try and build this team around Miles Turner's timeline. I think their long-term planning should be built around, you know, what do we want this team to look like when Miles Turner is 24, 25, 26, and, you know, what are the pieces that we want to put around him, and how do we get from here to there? Because I think, you know, this idea that, you know, Teague, Thad Young, Turner, George are going to become a championship contender with a couple pieces, you know, seems pretty far-fetched to me.
Yeah. Where do you think Turner stands amongst all the other young bigs in the league?
I think, clearly he's a tier or maybe even two below the, you know, Porzingis, Karl-Anthony Towns. I don't think he's, you know, he doesn't have those ball skills. But I think he could be a really special defensive player. And I think offensively, his jump shot, the range on his jump shot, his mobility in the pick and roll, and, you know, his ability to sort of develop a post game too that can punish mismatches. I think there's something really, you know, I think there's something special to be had there. Part of me is really curious what would have, you know, if the Pacers bottomed out and, you know, let's say traded George to Boston for a first round pick, or, you know, the Lakers for a first round pick. And, you know, went into next year with their core, you know, don't resign Teague, and go into next year with their core being Turner and, I don't know, Fultz or Josh Jackson or somebody like that. You know, what does this team look like when Turner's the one, you know, that the offense sort of revolves around? And what, you know, what could that pull out of his game that we sort of haven't had a chance to see yet because he's, you know, deferring to Paul George and these, you know, ball dominant, you know. Jeff Teague's a willing passer and a nice player in the pick and roll, but, you know, everybody else that's sort of around that, the Monte Ellis and Rodney Stuckey and all the other guys, Aaron Brooks, have handled the ball for them this year. You know, it would be interesting to me to see Turner, you know, to sort of be in a more central offensive role. I think we might see there's a lot more to his game than we've seen so far.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the right play, too. I kind of would be intrigued to see if they do something like that and what they could get and what kind of guys. Because I know you're a bit, and I kind of agree, there's the building a really long team, kind of like what Milwaukee's done, you know, to an extent, and you figure kind of out the rest as it goes on and then find the guard later. And because I'm one of the things I'm kind of curious about with Teague, he could make a ton of money. He's going to get a ton of money. But if you're in this market where you're getting, there's a lot of decent, like, Yogi Ferrell, Quinn Cook type replacement level point guards, why you need to spend that much money and allocate that much of your cap to a guy like Jeff Teague? Like, I kind of wonder if there's, like, that big enough of a gap there to justify a $20 million a year contract for a guy like that. I'm kind of curious how that sort of unfolds this summer, too, and what Indiana does, because they did kind of give up George Hill and go get him and kind of make those moves to specifically get Teague.
Yeah, I'm thinking as an outsider who doesn't actually, you know, I'm in inner workings of the Indiana front office, and I don't cover the team directly, but, it has seemed to me as an outsider over the past couple of years that there has been sort of a fetishization of the traditional point guard style of play. And I guess maybe some of that's coming from the fans and the local media as well. And I think Teague sort of fits this archetype of the kind of point guard they want. But like when you think about that archetype, it's really sort of flat and two-dimensional and not well-rounded. And so Teague checks a couple boxes that are useful and really helpful. You know, he can be a good three-point shooter. You know, he's a good creator off the dribble. He can play up-tempo. He's a willing passer. He does some really good things. I like Teague. I think he's a good player. But sort of fetishizing those things in the offense at the expense of thinking about how they fit with everybody else and the willingness to maybe accept something that's a little unconventional. The Pacers got Darren Collison and sort of wanted him to be this traditional sort of floor general, where his natural inclination was probably a little more sort of up-tempo, chaotic, a little more scoring than passing. And he sort of did his best to slot into that role and played admirably. And, I thought he did a nice job while he was here. But, then it was George Hill. And, that seemed like even a stranger fit. They got George Hill. They sort of asked him to be, again, sort of like a traditional, floor general. And it covered up some of the things that he, did really well. It ignored some of the other things that he did really well. I think it limited him, and a failure of imagination, I think, is how I would characterize, how the Pacers used George Hill. And then he, constant criticism because he wasn't this other thing that they, the team, maybe had sort of implied that they wanted. And, now George Hill's gone, and, we see his spot-up shooting and defense, really could have made a difference for this team. And the stuff that Teague did well was nice to have this year, but I don't know how important it was when also, you're sharing the ball with Ellis and Stuckey, and you're sort of asking, George to be a primary scorer and more of an on-ball creator. I like Teague. I would not want to invest the money that it's going to take to keep him in Indiana. And I think it locks them into being the kind of team that they are now for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. That's kind of where I stand, and that's great stuff. Just remind everyone before we get out of here where they can find you on the internet and just tease anything we, as a site, kind of have going on over at the Step Back. Because it's worth mentioning, we do have the rotation, like, every day. You can catch up on all the latest playoff news every morning by reading the rotation.
I'm on Twitter, at Hickory High, fan-sided NBA, and the Step Back's our premium vertical, so lots of great playoff coverage, all kinds of stuff, all different angles. And, yeah, the rotation's our daily sort of morning roundup of the stories from the night before. You get a couple different writers, a couple different perspectives, trying to look at something beyond just the plain game recap and who won and who scored the most, trying to find some of the smaller stories in there. So, yeah, lots of fun stuff going on. I encourage everybody to come check us out.
Yeah, go check it out. And we'll be back again tomorrow with another episode talking a little bit more about the Cavs' defense and the rebounding. And thanks again, Ian. This has been Locked On Cavaliers.